From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start the hour with an alarming new report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, that says the way humans are using the Earth's land is intensifying climate change and could threaten our food supply and lead to mass migration. More than 100 scientists from around the world analyzed how land management, including deforestation, could worsen food shortages, flooding, and droughts. Here's Dr. Valerie Masson-Delmotte speaking at today's press conference in Geneva.
Population growth and changes in consumption of food, feed, fiber, timber, and energy have caused unprecedented rates of land and freshwater use. We humans affect more than 70% of ice-free land. A quarter of this land is degraded. The way we produce food and what we eat contributes to the loss of natural ecosystems and declining biodiversity.
Scientists say the opportunity to address these threats is narrowing. Joining us now is Deborah Lawrence, a professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, there's a lot in this report. What would you say are the most important things that we should take away from it?
I think one thing that is extremely important is how very important the land surface is to our climate system. It's a two-way street. Climate affects the land and forests also affect the climate. The other important part of the report is that the land and forests in particular will play an important role in solving the climate problem, so that we have to think seriously not only about reducing fossil fuel emissions, but also about managing and restoring our land. And in the sort of easiest case, you can see that when you cut down a massive forest, like the rainforests in the tropics, you end up putting a ton of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But that's only half of what the land produces. The land actually contributes 22% of all greenhouse gases. So half of that is from deforestation. The other half is from the way we grow our food. We produce a lot of methane from livestock and rice paddies, and we produce a lot of nitrous oxide, which is from using fertilizers. So both of those are very strong greenhouse gases. And together with the CO2 from deforestation, we end up contributing a ton of greenhouse gases to our global warming problem.
You are actually in this report in the form of some of your research that involves rainfall and its effect on the climate. Tell us more about what you found and what's in this report from you.
I reviewed all the modeling studies that tried to understand what happens, say we end up losing tropical forests. It's a very dramatic scenario, but business as usual says we're just going to keep on deforesting without further action. So what I did was I looked at what the models show us for how that affects rainfall, not only locally, but globally. And it turns out that you end up affecting rainfall in other places around the world. Hmm. So, you know, could be that it's just 1,000 kilometers away, it could be in an entirely different hemisphere. So it's really quite alarming that with large enough scale deforestation, you can really remake the climate of the globe.
So I have to ask you the question that we ask at the end of a lot of reports about climate change and the effects of it, which is what can be done? What should be done right now to deal with this problem on a global scale?
Well, I would take that global scale and break it down to what governments need to do and then what people need to do. And I think governments need to put the policies in place, perhaps like carbon pricing, that will just incentivize all sorts of actions, including forest conservation and restoration. It will also incentivize better agriculture for carbon storage. Farmers have a lot of land under management, and just adding a little carbon to their soils would do a lot. But they need to be part of any carbon pricing solution. And then there's what you and I can do. And I would say there is no one who needs to waste food, because food waste is about, 5 to 10% of global emissions, according to the report. But we're wasting 25 to 30% of all the food we produce. That's just unconscionable. And I would say we can also eat a little bit less meat, but we don't need a lot of meat, and it doesn't all have to be beef. It could certainly be chicken.
That's because of methane, is why you're saying that.
Methane and the fact that we deforest land to provide food for cattle. You can't get away from all that deforestation as well. Mm-hmm. Finally, I would say we can vote. I think it's foolish to think that just by eating less meat or by eating all the food on your plate, you're going to change the world. What you're going to do is signal that you're personally committed. And then if you vote the way you believe, we'll end up making big progress.
That is Deborah Lawrence, who's a professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, talking with us about the new UN climate report, and we'll link to it at hereandnow.org. Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been hearing about generous tax breaks that cities and states offer to lure big corporations and the jobs that go with them. Case in point, Amazon's quest for a location for its second headquarters. And there are stories playing out in Camden, New Jersey. Since 2013, that state has awarded more than $1.6 billion in tax credits to get companies to move to Camden. Supporters point to an improving economy, but critics say taxpayers bear the burden of those incentives. Nick Pugliese from member station WHYY reports.
Reverend Levi Combs gets frustrated when he hears city officials declare Camden is rising.
Camden is not rising. The budget deficit is rising.
The pastor of the First Refuge Progressive Baptist Church mocked a recent letter that Camden Mayor Frank Moran sent to the state requesting more aid. It said there was no true fix to the city's revenue problem.
Well, I guess you can fix the revenue problem if you allow these corporations to continue to have municipal tax deferments.
Here's what he's talking about. In 2013, the city opted to provide a special tax incentive for many new companies. Anything they built would be free from property taxes for a decade. All they would owe is taxes on the land. After that, property taxes would slowly ramp up until, in year 20, they would pay the full amount. One trio of companies that took advantage of this received $245 million in state tax breaks to move to a new 18-story office tower on the Camden waterfront. Rather than paying the city roughly $91 million in property taxes over 20 years, the companies are expected to pay only $25 million. That's a savings of about 70%. To understand why the city did that, you have to go back to 2013, says Camden County Freeholder Director Lou Capelli.
At that time, Camden City was the most dangerous city in the nation, the highest poverty rate in the nation, the highest unemployment rate in the nation, the lowest graduation rate in the nation. It was a city in despair.
Who was going to invest in Camden without incentives, Capelli asked.
Nobody was going to. So in order to attract attention from the private sector, in Camden City exercised this option to make these favorable tax terms available. If not for them, we would not have the investment that we have in the city.
Camden now hosts corporations with a national profile, including the headquarters for Subaru and a practice facility for the Philadelphia 76ers basketball team. Crime is down, and the unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in decades. John Boyd is a corporate site selection expert based in Princeton, New Jersey. He says the local tax incentives were a key component of Camden's winning formula.
Economic development in 2019 is hyper-competitive. It's super-competitive. We call it the second war between the states. And all of the projects that have went to Camden in recent years very easily could have gone to lower-cost alternatives.
But not everyone believes the city or the state had to give away so much to attract corporations. Carl Davis is the research director at the Nonpartisan Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. He says incentives are rarely the deciding factor in where businesses choose to locate.
These companies are looking at things like the labor pool, the quality of the infrastructure, the access to markets. Their business fundamentals almost always trump tax incentives.
Instead of giving money away to companies that are doing things they probably would have done anyway, he says, cities and states should invest in things that are attractive to all businesses, like schools, infrastructure, and housing.
I think states and localities should stick to what they're good at, and that's direct investment in services that we know matter to local economies.
Many Camden residents have another objection to giving huge tax breaks to corporations. They don't think it's fair. Kelly Francis, who leads a group called the Camden City Taxpayers Association, says longtime residents and businesses are now subsidizing the newly arrived companies. He singled out Holtec, a nuclear services company that occupies public land and does not have to pay any property taxes at all.
What we're doing, the homeowners are subsidizing Holtec because we pay for the services that we provide to them, police service, police protection, we pay for fire protection, they use our water and sewer, infrastructure, they use our roads, but they pay nothing for the upkeep or the maintenance of those services.
According to an internal state analysis obtained by the Philadelphia Inquirer, Camden is more dependent on the state to cover its day-to-day operations than any other city in New Jersey. Of Camden's roughly $200 million budget last year, 60% came from state aid. The arrival of the new companies seemed like a chance for the city to dig out of that hole. But state officials said in their analysis they expect Camden's deficit to only get worse. City officials urge patience. After decades of decline, things are getting better, they say. And in a decade, property that was previously vacant will start generating significant revenue for the city. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Pugliese.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Did you know that tomorrow is National Book Lovers Day? All right, maybe it's not an official holiday, maybe we just made it up, but it's as good an excuse as any to put down our smartphones, pick up a book, and not just read it, reread it. That's our topic today with our go-to literary guy, Steve Almond. He's here in the studio with us. You out there participated as well. We did a Facebook shout-out. Hundreds of listeners weighed in with the books they like to reread. Steve, you're nodding. You're not surprised. And you were here recently to tell us about one you've reread, I don't know, hundreds of times, John Williams' 1965 novel about one small life that Williams makes very big, Stoner.
Yes, over and over and over again. And I have to say, like, I love Robin and I love the show. And I now love your listeners, an incredible amount, because there was literally hundreds of responses. And many of them, interestingly, overlap with my little list.
Okay, so we're going to hear your list. And top of the list, as we said, John Williams' Stoner. We'll link you to that segment at hereandnow.org. But talk about rereading. Some of the people responded, well, there's so many new books to read. Why reread?
Yeah, well, I think there's an American obsession with novelty and the newest thing, the latest thing that's out. And reading, actually, Nabokov has this great quote where he says, there's no such thing as reading, it's all rereading. And what he means is that literature, by its nature, reaches deeply enough into the human experience that you go back to it over and over again. Mm. We return to them in the same way that kids return to books. We want to go back to that same place. But each time we're a different person, and so we notice different things and new things about them. Mm. And I love that idea. I think this idea of summer reading should be only new things and only sort of thrillers that are superficial because everybody's out by the pool. I think that's a really condescending view of reading. And your listeners are affirming that because they exploded with all these suggestions of books that they return to again and again because it gives them something new each time.
Well, let's hear your list first.
Absolutely.
The Lover.
Yes, The Lover by Margaret Duras is 116 pages of like unbelievably gripping prose. It's about a tempestuous affair between a French teenage girl and her older Chinese lover set in colonial Indochina. It's about memory and love and family sorrow, and the prose is startling. I just want to read a little bit because it gives you a sense of how Duras sounds. I can't really remember the days, she writes. The light of the sun blurred and annihilated all color, but the nights, I remember them. The blue was more distant than the sky, beyond all depths, covering the bounds of the world. The sky for me was the stretch of pure brilliance, crossing the blue, that cold coalescence beyond all color. Sometimes when my mother was sad, she'd order the gig and we'd drive out into the country to see the night as it was in the dry season. I had that good fortune those nights. That mother, the light fell from the sky in cataracts of pure transparency, in torrents of silence and immobility. The air was blue. You could hold it in your hand, blue. Yes.
Okay.
And as much as it's about a love affair, it's also about love of the language and how immersed we are in our memories, especially our kind of teenage memories.
Mm, okay. Also on your list, Cat's Eye, Margaret Atwood, Female Friendship and Bullying. How
yes.
timely.
This is a 1988 novel that Atwood wrote that reaches so deeply into the subject of friendship and especially female friendship and gets at how, as she puts it in the book, a friend can be both lifeboat and shark all at once. They can be somebody who saves your life and in the next moment who absolutely dashes your hopes. Mm. And it follows the way in which the central character, who is an artist in her middle age, returns to Toronto where she was a teenager who was in the thrall of this kind of gang of girls, loved them dearly, was hopelessly devoted to them, and how mercilessly they bullied her and how much that stayed with her through her entire life, affected her relationships with women and men for
yep.
the rest of her life.
As it does. There's also on your list Money from Martin Amis. It's a funny book about a filmmaker in the 80s. The short story collection Birds of America, Laurie Moore.
Yeah, I love these stories. I've always loved them. And I included those two titles, Robin, because you know me, I tend to sort of choose books that gravitate toward the dark side of love, of friendship, whatever it is. These two books are both unsparing in their examinations of the dark side, and they're hilariously funny.
Okay.
I think people get it wrong. They think funny's the opposite of sad. Actually, funny's what we do because we're sad.
You reread Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me.
Yeah. So this is a book that's from 2015, so it's not an ancient book. And the reason I have reread it three or four times since it came out is because it is the one book in the midst of, I want to say, a sort of national climate of anxiety around race and an incredible amount of acrimony that is unbelievably eloquent and clear-eyed about race in America. It's really written in the tradition of James Baldwin, who I think is sort of the great under-recognized prophet of race in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Coates is writing an epistle, basically a letter to his teenage son that documents it's really an autobiographical account of his growing up in Baltimore and the way in which the black male body is essentially criminalized and under threat all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not an angry book. It is deeply and painfully insightful. I want to just read you a little bit of the way that Coates writes.
Okay.
You must resist the common urge toward the comforting narrative of divine law, toward fairy tales that imply some irrepressible justice. The enslaved were not bricks in your road, and their lives were not chapters in your redemptive history. They were people turned to fuel for the American machine. Now, a lot of people on the list actually wrote in praise of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I understood that impulse because that is a beautiful novel and a novel that suggests something quite optimistic about the role that whites can play in battling what Coates identifies quite clearly as the inevitability of white supremacy in America. And I would just commend those people who love that novel, as I do, To Kill a Mockingbird, if you haven't, or if you haven't recently, go back and read Between the World and Me. It's devastating in all the necessary ways.
Maybe read them together.
Yep.
Okay, David Foster Wallace's Consider the Lobster and Slouching Toward Bethlehem, Joan Didion. And by the way, we'll have your whole list at hearnow.org.
I'm lucky enough to teach a class to like journalists who are far better journalists than I'll ever be. And these are the first two writers that I give them is Didion and David Foster Wallace. When we read nonfiction, what we really want is to be in the presence of a great mind and heart on the page. Simple, direct language about what preoccupies those writers, what keeps them up, what feels urgent. And Foster Wallace is one of those guys who, it doesn't matter where you send him, he was going to find the most interesting question to ask about that place. Consider the Lobster, the essay, for instance, is him going to the Maine Lobster Festival and asking a very simple question that really stops readers dead in their tracks. Is it okay for human beings to torture a live animal for their own gustatory pleasure? And I also want to say that it's a very funny and far-reaching collection of essays, even as it's taking on serious terrain.
Okay. I want to make sure that we get to the listeners. I mean, hundreds of responses, but here's a couple. Rebecca Pele-Mare, The Grapes of Wrath. Christina Williamson, Outlander. Alexander Change, The Blue Castle. Ron Delusky, it looks like, Time and Again from Jack Finney. What are some that jumped out at you?
What jumped out at me, Robin, was the number of people who wrote about novels. And I want to give a little list. Anne of Green Gables came up again and again. Little Women, Jane Eyre, and all of them. I chose Ruby Fruit Jungle. That's the 1973 Rita Mae Brown book about a young woman coming into her own body and her own sexuality. She's a lesbian. And it was, upon rereading an entirely different novel from the one I read when I was 12 years old and did not understand really what it was about.
Wait, you read that at 12?
Okay, maybe 11. You're right. You got me. Maybe 10 with certain parts underlined. But the point is, it was a revolutionary book in the sense that it just took on Rita Mae Brown's own experience. Back in 1973, it was writing about the way in which it felt forbidden for her to love who she wanted to love.
It was.
It was forbidden. Yeah. And I think the reason that there are so many people choosing Anne of Green Gables, Little Women, Jane Eyre, this kind of book, is because it focuses, all of those books focus on female characters who are too smart and ambitious for their circumstances and who are trying to make their way in a world that criminalizes their sexuality or even more so their ambition. And that is the moment we're living in. And that's why returning to those novels is a different sort of experience, I think, than maybe when you read it when you're a teenage girl.
I think that's such a great point. I mean, part of rereading is you're a different person. I mean, as you said with Stoner, you read it as a young person and you saw one thing in it. Then you read it as a parent and you saw a completely different thing.
And I tried to choose books that feel very different. I mean, in this moment, lots of women are moving through the world and recognizing that their ambition and even their volition is being criminalized. I think that's the reason these books are on people's mind in the same way that people's anxieties about what, not just what's happening within us, but what's happening around us in the culture is resonating. And people are saying, let me go back to Kill the Mockingbird. That's a happier story, a story about a wished for sense of justice that a white lawyer takes it upon himself to feel and try to address the struggle of racial equality. I think that's the reason we return to books again and again. There's something that we haven't quite worked out either as people or as a country, and sometimes both.
Well, speaking of which, some other listeners, Shelley Woodson here liked Man's Search for Meaning, Eileen Connolly, A Prayer for Owen Meany.
Yes.
So we would still love your suggestions on our Facebook page and at hereandnow.org. You want to know mine?
Yes, I do. Of course I do.
Annie Dillard.
Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Oh, my gracious. Beautiful observations in the natural world. Yes. I got to throw in, because so many people chose Jane Austen, Persuasion of Pride and Prejudice. I just must say this on behalf of Jane Austen. I declare, after all, there is no enjoyment like reading. How much sooner one tires of anything than of a book. When I have a house of my own, I shall be miserable if I have not an excellent library.
We're done. Author Steve Almond. And by the way, another Annie Dillard favorite is Teaching a Stone to Talk, Jeremy, the essay Living Like Weasels. I know how it sounds, but it's better than it sounds.
I would say I just read Blue Latitudes about Captain Cook by Tony Horowitz. I would read that again. It was fantastic.
Read that again. Okay, add that to the list. What's your favorite reread? Again, leave a comment on Facebook or at hereandnow.org.
The high-end workout chains Equinox and SoulCycle are facing backlash today after the Washington Post reported that the chairman and founder of their parent company, that would be Stephen Ross, is hosting a big-ticket fundraiser for President Trump in the Hamptons on Friday. Members of the chains went on social media to demand Ross cancel his fundraiser, which will charge guests up to $250,000 a pop for a chance to join a roundtable discussion with President Trump. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
And tell us more about how this whole thing blew up so fast.
Yeah, you remember Bonfire of the Vanities? This is more like Brush Fire of the Influencers.
Okay.
There's, I don't know if that's a little tortured as usual, but the comedian and actor Billy Eichner, he sports more than 2 million Twitter followers. He tweeted, "Hey, Equinox, what's your policy for canceling memberships once a member finds out your owner is enabling racism and mass murder?" Close quote. Star Trek legend George Takei piles on. He exhorts his followers to know where your money is going. So all of this started trending and accelerating. You know, Steve Ross owns the Miami Dolphins. I'm a huge Miami Dolphins fan. And suddenly my friends on Twitter and Facebook were in a back and forth tirade over the otherwise mundane development of a billionaire throwing a fundraiser for a Republican president.
When I'm just looking on Twitter right now, Mika Brzezinski from Morning Joe tweets, "No more SoulCycle. We'll never go there again. We'll never go to Hudson Yards or Equinox ever." How have the companies responded?
I mean, nervously, they're very invested in dark blue places where Trump is especially unpopular. I mean, you talk about Midtown Manhattan. Still, they're trying frantically to explain on Twitter, wait, don't just run and cancel your membership. We didn't give money to Trump. Stephen Ross is just a passive investor. Maybe so, but when you get the likes of supermodel Chrissy Teigen, who has more than 11 million Twitter followers, you know, vociferously arguing as much on her handle, you're just trying to push sand against the tide if you're these companies.
Now, in July, we saw a similar boycott effort against Home Depot, whose former CEO, Bernie Marcus, also said he plans to support Trump again in 2020. Do these boycotts have an impact?
You know, we've seen it work on and off with respect to Fox News. When an anchor or commentator makes a particularly incendiary comment and social media notices and then calls out the commercial sponsors, whether it's a pharmaceutical or a home builder, and then said personality is suddenly on hiatus for a couple of weeks. I mean, of course, those brands were advertising on Fox News in the first place because of the perceived brand staying power mm-hmm. with its core demo. So you're always balancing one versus the other.
And I wonder if we're going to see some of the competitors of Equinox and SoulCycle step in here and try to take advantage of the situation the way that Lyft did, pledging $1 million to the ACLU during the travel ban because of the hashtag delete Uber.
Well, you did see New York Sports Club come in and try to do like a mild troll. And it tweeted, FYI, this Friday, August 9th, we're not doing anything in Southampton. Come work out with us. But it's really difficult. If you're a national chain, suppose you're Planet Fitness, you were to come in and take a stand, how much would you then be vilified on the right or dissuaded by shareholders who simply don't want to wade into to politics? But, you know, Jeremy, you did see Nike make that calculated risk.
Right. Nike, there were boycotts because of Colin Kaepernick becoming a brand ambassador, and there were boycotts from the right against Nike.
I mean, it boils down to the fact that you've never seen the president of the United States and his agenda treated as this radioactive by Main Street brands. I mean, mm-hmm. sports brands, teams, players. It's really a divided time.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Wealthy entrepreneur Andrew Yang is tweeting out that he's qualified for the next round of Democratic presidential debates in September, joining Biden, Booker, Buttigieg, Sanders, Warren, Harris, Klobuchar, and O'Rourke in getting 2% in four polls and donations from 130,000 people. We've been speaking with the candidates. All our interviews so far, including with Yang, are at herenow.org. And we'll soon add Washington Governor Jay Inslee. He joins us now from Seattle. Governor Inslee, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Well, you are billing yourself as the 2020 climate candidate. Many people know that, and we want to talk about that. But two mass shootings, you know, within 13 hours. If you were president in this moment with Mitch McConnell leading a Republican majority Senate, what would you do?
Well, first, we have to remove Donald Trump, who I correctly identified as a force allowing and enabling white nationalism in the White House to be removed. And I said that at the last debate stage. Several days later, we had this horrendous event in El Paso, clearly motivated by racial animus.
But what do you say to Americans who say these shootings have been going on for decades?
I say that there's no reason to make them worse by having a president who will wake up every morning trying to figure out how to divide us. Now, we also need meaningful common sense gun legislation. I have believed this for a long time. I'll just give an example what I mean by that. In 1994, I was a freshman legislator from Eastern Washington in a Republican district, and the bill to ban assault weapons came up, and I knew if I voted to ban assault weapons, I would lose my seat in Congress. And I went ahead and voted to ban assault weapons. I did lose my seat, but I have never regretted that vote for one heartbeat. We now hope that if we have a president to lead, we can again ban assault weapons, as I have proposed. We can do the things that we've done in Washington State under my governorship. We've now passed three common sense gun safety legislation, making sure we have extreme risk protection orders, make sure we close the gun show loophole. We now need to close the Charleston loophole. And importantly, we need to empower the federal government to fight white nationalism.
You mentioned a couple of things. The Charlestown loophole, that allows a firearms dealer who has started a background check but hasn't heard back from the FBI within 3 business days. They can go ahead with the sale. You would close that. How do you propose to ferret out white nationalist extremists when much of what they are saying online, for instance, some have noted that the president has used some of the same language, but they have free speech?
Well, we have been somewhat successful, well, considerably successful, fighting international terrorism. The number of plots that have been interdicted is actually very, very impressive. And our intelligence resources, while respecting First Amendment rights, can be successful if they are targeted to the threat. But this president has been consistent in diminishing the ability of the federal government to protect us from white nationalism. He has reduced the actual dollar resources going into these events, even though the FBI director just most recently said that the majority of arrests for terrorism have been involved in white nationalism and domestic terrorism. So this has been a conscious effort by this occupant of the White House to diminish our ability to protect citizens from this threat.
Let's move to climate change, because you have said you want to be the climate change candidate. This is going to be your first priority. You want to shift towards 100% clean energy, a moonshot federal project to slash emissions, a climate test for all new infrastructure, a national prohibition on fracking, a global climate mobilization to reshape foreign policy around climate change. What do you say, though, to people who say money? How do you have a check on how things are built without hurting the construction industry? How do you prohibit fracking when that's allowed us to move away from coal? How would you pay for it?
Well, we are going to make prodigious amounts of money and create prodigious numbers of jobs by building a new clean energy economy. This will be the largest building project in the United States since the interstate freeway system. And the reason is we have to rebuild our physical infrastructure to not waste so much energy. That is an enormous opportunity for jobs for carpenters and laborers and electricians, not just physicists and mechanical engineers. Look, the expensive route is allow forest fires to continue to burn down whole towns like has happened in California. It is too expensive to allow floods to continue to destroy billions of dollars of agricultural productivity in the Midwest. It is too expensive not to act.
You're getting a lot of applause, too, for this, but you're also getting some criticism. For instance, you want to put a price on carbon so people will, you know, be nudged to use less of it. We're reading activists in your state saying that is so yesterday. You know, they've moved on to no coal, period. And they say you made missteps and, you know, played catch up with local issues. And these are people like Andrea Rogers of the group Our Children's Trust or 350 Seattle co-founder Michael Foster.
Well, I don't know what you're referring to because I've not heard any of those criticisms. In fact, Ocasio-Cortez has called my plan the gold standard. Greenpeace has rated it as the highest energy.
Oh, no
program.
Doubt. You've gotten tons of applause.
I just got started. Bill McKibben just sent out a tweet saying, you know, asking people to help out. This is clearly by every single group that has evaluated the clean energy visions of the multiple candidates, and there are 24. All of them agree that mine is the most aggressive, most robust, and comprehensive. So I really don't know what you're referring to.
Well, these are local activists from Washington State.
Well, I'll have to give them a call because I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, call up Michael Foster. He's with 350 Seattle.
Oh, yes. I do know Michael. Yeah. He's griped about everything that the Mariners are not winning the series yet. So I know Michael. I will rather call Greenpeace and have a discussion about the best program, which is clearly mine.
Well, as I said, I am acknowledging you have been, you know, applauded for this. And we are also, you know, we want to ratchet up concerns about climate change. But that brings us to a headline in the New York Times. Climate change is catching on with voters. Why isn't Jay Inslee? You well know that you're not in that top, you and many others aren't in that top tier of 5 candidates. Why is that? Because you are so passionate about the immediacy of this problem, the fact that there can't be failure. Polls show people agree with you. What's the disconnect? What do you need to do?
Well, 2 things we are catching on. Since the last debate, we've had over 20,000 new donors. We're now about 112,000. But the fact of the matter is that 2/3 of Americans could not pick me out of a lineup yet. And we are still at the stage of a campaign of introducing ourselves to the American public. And that is the experience of Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter as well when they started. And so we're just in the building process, and that takes time. I do want to come back, mention one other thing on why my climate policy has been called the best by far. And the reason is because it actually complies with the scientific certainty of the dates by which we have to get off carbon. And mine is the only plan that actually guarantees we will do that, get off coal in 10 years and fossil fuels in our electrical grid in 15. And the other candidates, I think, have not been as ambitious as the science demands. So that's why we're getting accolades.
Okay. Jay Inslee, former lawyer, you credit a lot of your appreciation for the natural world, according to the New York Times, to your father, who was a high school science teacher. For people, as you said, who couldn't pick you up out of a lineup, which I doubt you'll ever be in one, what is something you'd want them to know about you that they don't know?
I'm going to go for two, if that's okay. I'm going to
sure.
go for a bonus round.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would want them to know is why I'm running for president, and I think that's maybe the most important thing. And that is that I've been a very successful governor. We've got the best economy in the country. We've had enormous progressive policies that have been adopted under my watch. But I decided that on my final day on Earth, I want to be able to look at my three grandchildren and tell them that I did everything humanly possible to save them from this enormous cataclysm of the climate crisis. And that is a personal commitment. The second thing I would hope that they would know, that is not the singular accomplishment that I have had or will have. If you look at our record, the very first public health care option in America we've adopted in our state, the very first long-term care plan for our senior citizens in American history we've adopted. We now have the strongest gender pay equity law in the United States. So what I hope they would know is I have an intense, passionate, and very focused approach to save us from the climate crisis, but that's not all you'll get if I'm president of the United States. I've got quite a bit to offer, and I hope people will take a look.
Washington Governor and presidential candidate Jay Inslee, thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Don't forget to vote.
We got some time. And out there, is the climate crisis a consideration for you in picking a presidential candidate? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
An interesting science experiment played out on Twitter this week. Physicist and inventor Seamus Blackley chronicled his effort to make a loaf of sourdough bread using yeast that he says has been dormant for more than 4,000 years. Blackley and a team of scientists extracted a strain of yeast from ancient Egyptian pottery. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with Blackley and joins me now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how did Seamus Blackley find this ancient strain of yeast?
I think it's important to point out that Seamus Blackley is a man of many interests. First of all, he is the inventor of the video game console, the Xbox.
Oh,
he
wow.
is a physicist. He calls himself an amateur baker, an amateur self-described Egyptologist. So he gets these scientists together, one of them a microbiologist from the University of Iowa, Richard Bowman, and they convince a museum in Boston to give them access to old pottery. We're talking about vessels that carried beer, molds that once held bread. These are 4,500 years old, and they were used in ancient Egypt, and they suspected that there had been hibernating spores of yeast inside them. Now, yeast gives bread its flavor. It helps it rise. It can also lay dormant for a really, really long time.
This, by the way, reminds me of like Jurassic Park where they get the mosquito out of the
amber. Exactly. Yeah. So they took these spores out, and Blackley, in our conversation, essentially explains how it works.
So the idea was, if we can find vessels that held beer and were used to ferment bread and all of this, maybe after decades of use in ancient Egypt, these spores would be driven into the ceramics. And if we could find a technique to extract them, maybe we could get them out. Maybe we'd get a pure sample. Because other people have like scraped the surface, and that's all contaminated from modern yeast. You know, the advent of Wonder Bread has spread this contaminant yeast all over the place. But Richard came up with a technique kind of like microbiological fracking, of pumping a nutrient bath deep into the ceramic and then vacuum it out along with the organism inside. And that's what we did.
Wow. And you found the ancient hibernating spores of yeast inside the pottery.
Yeah, we think so. So we haven't proven it yet. But on the side, just to try and see what would happen, I stole one of my samples from myself and raised it carefully with total sterile technique, like psychotically in my kitchen, so it didn't get contaminated, and baked some bread with it. And the bread was really different in character and a different flavor. So I was really surprised, like, maybe there's something in this. But again, now we need to do, you know, science work.
So you know you found something because you were able to bring it back to life. How do you do that? How do you bring those dormant spores back to life?
You feed it. It's really pretty simple. When it doesn't have food, it goes to sleep. Mm-hmm. When it gets food again and gets wet, it wakes up. So what I did is I took some einkorn, which is this ancient wheat that humans have been cultivating for a really long time, genetically identical to the wheat that we find in pharaoh's tombs and Sumerian temples and all this stuff, and made flour out of it, sterilized it, and fed it, and it woke up.
And it tasted different?
Yeah, it was ridiculously good. Huh. Look, you know, I don't want to claim too much because I don't know for sure.
Yeah,
that this wasn't just yeast that was a surface contaminant that I'm making something out of. But I've baked a lot of sourdough and I've made a lot of starters. I know what I'm talking about. And it smelled genuinely different.
How so?
It was richer. It had sort of brown sugar overtones. And it was surprisingly deep and sweeter than a lot of sourdough can be. And the way that this starter was able to rise this ancient grain was really impressive to me. And it's a, you know, it's a subtle thing. You got to remember, though, that modern wheat was invented after this yeast went to sleep. Hmm. Like all of everything we think about at bread didn't exist yet when this yeast hibernated. It only knew ever these old grains. And it turns out it's really good at them, if that's what it is.
So did you feel like when you were doing this that somehow you were kind of unlocking a time capsule?
Of course, that's the whole point. The point is that, you know, with hieroglyphics, you can hear the voices of these people, our ancestors, from 5,000 years ago. And you can hear them as people. We think of people in antiquity as being stupid or ignorant, and they absolutely were not. They were as sophisticated or more sophisticated than we are in many things. Being able to hear them by reading what they wrote because of the preservation of that record is really cool. Mm. Being able to take them the next step and share a meal with them, I think, is incredible.
That was Seamus Blackley speaking with Peter O'Dowd. Peter, I have to say, the one question that's in my head is, how do we know this is for real? How can he prove that this yeast is actually from ancient Egypt?
That's a completely legitimate question. For one, storing pottery in a museum for a really long time, it's going to collect things like dust and dirt and grime from the modern day that's going to have to be separated out. Secondly, Blackley did this in his kitchen. Now, he is a scientist. He knows about rigorous standards, but can he possibly make it sanitary enough, laboratory conditions in his kitchen? I don't know. But that's why the next step now is to take all the samples of the yeast that they've collected mm-hmm. and sequence the DNA and then compare it to modern day strains to see if, in fact, it is something new or something very old.
You know, I'm just reminded of Clark W. Griswold in the beginning of Vegas Vacation when he shows off his food preservatives and he gives his kids cookies that are 8 years old. Imagine getting a loaf of bread that's 4,000 years old. Here now is Peter O'Dowd. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I don't feel like that sandwich that we had when it was 4,000 years old. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.